This is Ed Mazur, chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Our program today, most interesting program, featured three inspector generals. Joseph Ferguson, who's in his third term as the City of Chicago's inspector general. Patrick Blanchard, the inspector general for Cook County government. He's in his second term. And Nicholas Schuler, who has served as inspector general for the Chicago Board of Education, Chicago Public Schools, since December of 2014. Three inspector generals, all talking about similar problems. The number of positions that they need to investigate, the number of performance audits that they do in city, county, and the Chicago public school system, the legacy of a history of patronage and political hiring, the development of transparency, which still has yet to reach its fruition. All the inspector generals said, what they're interested in doing is, how can we as agencies avoid problems that will come up in the future? That's why we insist on doing audit and performance audits. Pat Blanchard of Cook County said, since the Inspector General's office has been established, they now have their own budget, their own subpoena power, and the ability to protect whistleblowers. The city's Inspector General, Joe Ferguson, and Chicago Public Schools Inspector General Nicholas Schuler also agreed that those kind of protections are necessary when you're overlooking and investigating such large bodies of government as the city, the county, and the Board of Education. There'll be new hires in the Chicago Public Schools because of financial mismanagement, sexual abuse charges, and resignations. All three inspector generals said, pay attention because in the next few weeks, there'll be more revelations to come. All three agencies are establishing best practice guidelines, and they all agreed, compared to other metropolitan areas, Chicago right now is on the cutting edge. The bottom line, they said, all inspector generals' offices need subpoena powers, they need separate budgets, and they need statutory protection in order to provide clear, concise, and intelligent information to the taxpaying public. The three agencies try to interact when they can, but they each have different responsibilities. Of all the investigations that they are involved with, the county says 85% of their office's recommendations are adopted. Joe Ferguson said probably about 90% in the city of Chicago, and Nicholas Schuler said a similar number. The Inspector Generals of Chicago, Cook County, and the Public Schools, the Troika, brought to you by the City Club of Chicago. Joe Ferguson, you want to start us off? Because your two colleagues said you'd be glad to do that.
So thank you, Ed, on behalf of all three of us. Thank you all for being here. Our agreement yesterday when we talked in advance was I would be the last one to speak. So I think there's a bit of some sort of operation ongoing that I wasn't read into. Conspiracy, collusion of some sort. But I'm delighted to be here. We've been told we should take about 4 minutes, and I'm going to keep to that 4 minutes because I think more importantly here are the questions that you all have. Just briefly, if nothing else, you'll walk away with knowledge that there actually are three of us and that we're not the same person using different names, which sort of goes to some of the confusion and lack of understanding about the IG function in the greater Chicago area and how and all the different ways that it operates. Our office has existed in its current iteration since 1989, having been one of the early legislative initiatives of Richard M. Daley when first elected mayor. And as Ed has indicated, it has grown over time. Right now it has approximately 98 appropriated positions. The sections of the office include investigations, for which it is historically what it has been known for, audit and program review, which performs GAO, Yellow Book, performance audits of programs and operations of city government. The CD unit, the Center for Information Technology and Analytics, as Ed also mentioned, which is about a dozen people, and we'll talk a little bit about that, I think, as we go forward here and talking about transparency. Hiring Oversight Unit, which is the sort of the legacy of the 45 years of Shackman litigation. Our office is responsible actually for making sure the city stays within constitutional bounds in its employment and hiring practices, a legal section and administrative section, and the newest section, the public safety section, which is specifically responsible for oversight from a program and evaluation perspective of not just the police department, but the accountability mechanisms of the police department. That's a lot going on, and basically it operates under an enabling ordinance that largely tracks the Federal Inspector General Act. To sort of highlight why all those different units, because I think in public perception, IGs are about getting bad guys. And that is part of their job, to investigate wrongdoing, remove the malfeasance, and recover money. But there's another component of what it is that they ought to be doing. And I will tell you, this other component is why I became an IG after 15 years of being a federal prosecutor. And that's the component that actually examines government operations. Any situation that involves malfeasance quite often involves some form of shortcoming in how a program is being operated. And investigators and prosecutors have to focus, keep their eyes on the prize, on the bad guys and the recovery of money. But there's this bigger question as to how do we avoid it in the future. And that's where performance audit comes into play. And one example of how that has worked in our office in recent years is in the context of the red light camera program, where an audit by our office resulted in findings that spurred, I believe, the Tribune to start to pull threads with respect to other aspects of the city's vendor for that program. And they uncovered some stuff, and we took those threads and started to pull them as an investigative matter that resulted in the prosecution of three people. One, the number two person in the city's Department of Transportation, responsible for the management of that program, and in his spare time also an assistant dugout manager for the Chicago White Sox during the year that they won the World Series. Only in Chicago could you actually hold both of those jobs, I believe. The CEO of the company, of the vendor, and the middleman, and the result was that the city official, a jail sentence, very long federal jail sentence of 10 years, but equally important, all three of them had an obligation to pay restitution to the city of $2 million. And from the work in that investigation that yielded requests from the city council and the mayor's office to do a more thoroughgoing examination of the red light camera program, that resulted in widespread changes in not only how it operates and who operates it, but the amount of information that is available to the public. One other thing that resulted from that investigation was a civil lawsuit filed by the city that resulted in the recovery of $20 million to the city as a result of this of losses to the city stemming from what was a 10-year kickback scheme. So it's that dynamic and that synergy between the program evaluations and the investigations that really is the sort of the essence of what an IG ought to be doing. And I know that both of the people on either side of me live in that space, not merely as a matter of responsibility, but as a matter of values. And so I'm delighted to be on the panel with them, and I'll stop there and turn it over to next.
Thanks, Joe. Good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here. If I could just take a couple of minutes and maybe describe for you the evolution of the Office of the Independent Inspector General in Cook County. The OIG Enabling Ordinance was passed back in 2007. If you recall the climate at that time, there was the federal hiring probe into the City of Chicago unlawful patronage hiring scheme, and the conviction of four individuals back in September of 2006. Later that month, the FBI executed search warrants on the county side of the building at 118 North Clark. There was no convictions that grew out of that investigation, but it became painfully clear that Cook County's patronage practices continued to be unlawful despite the promises that it made years ago in the Shachtman litigation that Joe referred to and I'm sure we'll talk about later on. So the OIG was really a creation of the climate that was then existing at that time. And it's really been an honor for me to have built the office since my arrival in 2008 and helping it kind of establish a presence in Cook County government. When the OIG ordinance was passed, it had most of the important elements of a strong and independent inspector general office. And those are, you know, for example, having an IG who's selected separate and apart from the executive branch. The IG should have a term, should only be removed for cause after a hearing. There should be no outside influence in the operation of the office. Importantly, the investigations that are pursued by the IG should be done based on the mission of the office and not be influenced from any source outside the office. And just as important, decisions made with regard to complaints and investigations not to pursue should be made internally and not externally. The OIG ordinance created obligations on behalf of Cook County employees to actually report corruption. That's a really important element of transparency I think we should talk about a little bit later on. And over the years, we've tweaked the ordinance a little bit, quite a bit actually, to include some additional measures. For example, the office, we have internally the authority to pursue or to enforce all our subpoenas. We don't have to go through Cook County government for that. That's an important aspect of the office. Also critically, we changed a portion of the ordinance that required an investigation of an elected official to be based on a sworn affidavit provided by somebody to the office. It became very clear early on in my tenure that that provision of the ordinance was just, it was so chilling that people weren't coming forward when it was obvious that they probably should be coming forward. To the Cook County Board's credit, they amended that ordinance and allowed the Inspector General to pursue investigations of elected officials without a sworn affidavit by a complainant. So it hasn't always been smooth sailing with regard to transparency, that's for sure. Over the course of several years, beginning in 2012 and ending just last year, we struggled with several Cook County agencies who were outside of the Cook County Board with regard to their cooperation with our office in tendering records and investigations. It culminated with a Supreme Court decision last year where the court held that all Cook County elected officials, and there's 27 of them, 27 independently elected Cook County officials, are required to cooperate with the Inspector General with regard to investigations that are initiated by the office. You might recall, you might have read something about the litigation involved the assessor's office, but truth be told, the assessor was not the only elected official in Cook County government that resisted our efforts to seek their cooperation in pursuing investigations. So when you think about transparency, I also think it's important not only think about transparency from the perspective of a public government facing the public, but also how is that public government, how is that government insofar as it faces the Inspector General's office, its employees, and how is the employee and contractor world, are they being transparent with the government itself? Those are the issues that I think we probably should talk about a little bit more today. Well, Cook County has come a long way. There's no question since when I started in 2008, things were very dark in Cook County when it came to information and supplying rationale for the why decisions were being made. That being said, inspiring transparency is an ongoing effort, clearly, and Cook County has not achieved 100% success in that regard. There's no question about it, but they importantly have developed an interest and a willingness and a capacity to open up government quite a bit. For example, there's 603 open databases that can be accessed by the public through the open portal. But because Cook County, the umbrella of Cook County government is so broad, as I said before, 27 elected officials, their agencies and employees, there still is a lot of work to be done. So again, thank you for having me here today. I look forward to questions later on.
Thank you. Sure.
Thanks. So the Inspector General for the Public Schools, you know, we're the oversight body for a $6 billion organization. over 640 plus schools, including the charter schools and the contract schools, and over 29,000 employees, and those are just the CPS employees. So our office has been around since 1996. We're a creature of state statute. We're in the Illinois School Code. Critically, under the code, we're independent from the operations of the board, and so we're independent. As Pat said, no one, people can suggest we open things, we take complaints, but at the end of the day, we decide what we open up cases. We don't have to wait for it to come through a certain avenue. We can proactively investigate cases, which is initiate cases and reviews, which is a critical part of what IGs do. Without that power, you know, any office would sort of be deficient. Our general mandate is to investigate waste, fraud, financial mismanagement, and the board years ago gave us general power to investigate all employee misconduct. That was on top of the state statute. So for last year, we had 19 positions. We were budgeted just over $2 million, but there's a big change coming our way. As Ed said in the introduction, you know, I did ask to take over sex investigations from the law department in wake of the news that the Tribune's been reporting. And so the board is going to give that to us. We're going to take over all adult on student allegations of abuse, sexual abuse, sexual harassment. And we're going to get a fair amount bigger. So we're going to take on probably at least 12 people more for that. And we expect our budget to grow accordingly. So shedding light on, you know, government waste and wrongdoing, that's what we're all about. That's what Joe and Pat said. And so our office has been sort of at the forefront of a couple big transparency efforts that I'll talk about. First example is last year, was referenced in the introduction, is the investigation into the ethics violations by Ronald Marmer and, as it turned out, Forrest Claypool, CEO. And so, you know, the key thing that was issued there, it was access to documents, access to records. So under our statute, we have access to all records and personnel. But they were making an exception because they were using the attorney-client privilege to say we couldn't have access to certain information. And it turns out that was the key information. And I had to escalate the issue publicly because it was getting nowhere, trying to have internal discussions about that point and our need for information. And I took the unusual step of speaking before the board meeting. And it even took some follow-up after that, but eventually that is what broke the dam, and we were able to get the key information that showed that the general counsel had been violating, not only they had been violating it, but that they knew about it, people had tried to warn them about it, and then critically that the CEO had taken steps to have documents changed to try to hide the fact that he had been told about it. So, you know, that would not have come to light at all, but for the fact that we were able to penetrate that veil of attorney-client privilege or have it waived in that respect, which is what was required in that result, or I mean, in that situation. So it turns out that there were also lies, as they said, throughout the investigation. Another area we shed light recently was last year reported that based on an investigation we found out that 163 former CPS employees who had been either let go or resigned or left for one reason or another had been designated as ineligible for rehire, what's known as a DNH. And so we during one investigation we found out that we had reason to believe that at least some were working at charter schools, people who the public schools wouldn't rehire themselves, were found working at charter schools. So we did a bigger investigation to find out the extent of that. We came up with 163 people who had this designation. You know, it wasn't known to the charters, it wasn't known to CPS how many the extent of this problem, or even if at all. And critically, a handful of those employees were found to have been ineligible for rehire because of they had committed sexual misconduct involving children. So, you know, there was some very serious things among the class of people. And our work resulted in a new system of information sharing, so to prevent this in the future. And, of course, that's all directly related to the board's decision last month to have us investigate these sexual abuse cases. You know, it was driven by the press. And I think the big point, the big takeaway here is that by our office doing these investigations, we're going to be shedding a lot more light into this area, that the public will know how many investigations we've done, how many are sustained. We'll be providing information as appropriate, you know, given the sensitivity of the victims about this. So what previously had been a big black hole should we should be providing a lot more data and information about what's going on, and you know, the deterrence value of that alone should be huge, I expect. And just my last point is that we have a lot of openings right now. I suspect people in this room know people who would be well suited to work in our office, and we're looking for everything from team chiefs and attorneys to investigators. So if you know anybody, send them to cpsoig.org. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. So a number of people here will be getting their resumes ready, so you better be ready. Nick, I'm telling you. Okay, so we have time for questions now. I see a blue question card up. We'll handle as many questions as we possibly can in our allotted time. Okay, so here's the first question. This is from Jane Grover, who's with the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning. You know, we always ask on our question forms, are you a member of the City Club? Because if you're not, we're going to hound you. So guess what she says? I'm not, but my father is. You're an adult. You have your own income. Okay? And we appreciate your father. Where are you, Jane, by the way? Okay, back there. Thank you. Here's our question. We aspire to good government, but it's all on-the-job training for elected officials. Where are the resources, such as ethics training, professional development, for elected officials? Who would like to? Joe, you want to jump in on that?
That's a fantastic question. There are 50 aldermen of the city council, and about... About 2 years ago, our jurisdiction was expanded to include investigative oversight of them, and everybody thought, "Oh, baby, here it comes." And in the first sort of look at the city council, what we saw was it was a fantastically under-supported and under-guided with respect to things like ethics and basic sort of management of operations of ward offices, and historically really did not have the benefit of the city that they are elected officials representing. And so we are in the tail end of a fairly extended initiative where there's basically a round table that involves the Inspector General's office, the Board of Ethics, the Department of Human Resources, the Finance Office, the Law Department, and a pretty sizable representative sample of the City Council itself, working through all of the challenges that the elected officials have in the operation of their office and in the day-to-day management of their responsibilities, to create basically a platform, a guidance, a handbook of exactly what their responsibilities are, best practices for how they should be looking to conduct their business in the ward offices and in City Hall. So ethics, finance, invoicing, things like social media and how you actually manage social media in relation to things like campaign finance, all sorts of things like that, so that for the first time, we hope, within a couple of months, all members of the City Council will have a place to look to understand actually what the best practices are. And these aren't just best practices as devised internally, but these are best practices on the basis of the subject matter expertise of all of the departments within the city that ought to be serving them and supporting them, all with the goal of freeing them from sleepless nights. And in making the rounds, I actually ask a lot of aldermen, what keeps you up at 3 in the morning? And most of them actually say campaign finance and my reporting obligations around that, to provide them with the guidance that actually frees their mind to actually focus on their primary responsibilities in representing their constituents.
Thank you. Pat, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, in the interest of full transparency, Jane happens to be my sister-in-law. But putting that aside.
Your sister-in-law?
Yes.
Excellent. You're going to get her to join the City Club.
Give
her a gift membership for next Christmas.
Joe's comments are right on, but I'd like to just to add to that a little bit. Training is, you know, critically important with regard to a population like, you know, we have in large governments like this. But one thing that training does do help, and I think is really the overreaching important notion in just about everything that we do, and that's inspiring people to do the right thing. When I came to Cook County government, if somebody would have received a telephone call from an elected official, and the elected official would say something along the lines of, this is not an effort to influence your hiring of somebody this afternoon, because I know you're in the position to, you know, fill this position, but I just want you to know that I know Pat. Have a good day. In the old days, if that phone call would have been made, the atmosphere was such that that person wouldn't tell anybody else, would have to hold that information themselves, and struggle with what to do, you know, whether or not they're going to be subject to some kind of discipline or some kind of retribution, or whether or not they should do the right thing. But what has happened in county government, I believe, I'd like to think, is that now we live in an atmosphere where if a call like that is being made, that both parties, both the caller and the callee, know that what is transpiring is not right. It shouldn't happen. You know it. I know it. You know it. And I know that you know it. And it gets out. And I think that having an environment like that really propels good government, even better than I think making people sit down and go to a training, which they may or may not understand.
Nick, do you want to chime in?
I mean, just briefly, I think at CPS, there's, you know, the ethics component outside of our office is largely handled by the ethics officer. And the real obvious thing is that she's just one person, and I think she's understaffed, and I think she, to have sort of the robust, comprehensive program that Joe's talking about would take some bigger dedication and resources on CPS side.
Okay, good. This is a question from Bill Bergman, who's with Truth in Accounting. Bill, where are you? Right over there. And I don't know, Pat, this might be right up your alley, or Nick, maybe even Joe. His question is, do suburban school districts have an equivalent OIG, or do any of you have any jurisdiction there?
I think the answer to that question is no, as far as I know. In Illinois, the federal government established the inspector general role back in the 1960s, 1975, I think, is when the federal statute was passed. In Illinois, beginning in 1989, really, there was a movement towards IGs. But currently, not many local governments, municipalities, and even parts of the state of Illinois don't have inspector general oversight. And I believe the school districts are those.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. There are a couple exceptions where an attorney or firm has sort of been hired to be the IG, but it's not a full-time job. The scale and scope of their, their mandates aren't, legislatively based. It's not clear. You know, they sort of have agreements with the board. So I think that exists sort of an ad hoc basis. I think sometimes people are kind of private inspector generals that get hired on a contract basis. I think that goes on. And, I don't have a lot of great knowledge about it, but anecdotally, I think there was talks some years ago about making a state of Illinois IG to cover, you know, the rest of the state, you know, school, you know, kind of have a big statewide IG for the rest of the school districts.
If I could just add to that, there is a bill pending downstate right now that was offered by Senator Michael Connolly. There was an amendment to the State Ethics Act, which would require every municipality and local government in Illinois to have an ethics officer or an inspector general, or enter into an intergovernmental agreement to achieve that. But my understanding is the bill is not progressing as quickly as some might like.
Okay, this question is directed to Joe Ferguson. Joe, you currently have power to investigate members of the City Council, but not to conduct audit and program reviews of the way they expend resources. Would you like to have that power?
Yes.
Okay. You think you'll ever get it?
I'll give you a little bit more. Look, there are a number of oddities to the government of the city of Chicago. At one level, in the broad brush, the public has an impression of the city of Chicago encompassing not just the part of it that my office has oversight of, but NICS and a number of other components. We have the Park District IG, who's also the president of the Illinois Association of Inspectors General, sitting in the back of the room there. Will Fletcher. Will, I thought you were supposed to be in a bunker at some removed location in case they took all of us out at once here today. But what we have this interesting thing in Chicago where there is one person that actually exercises influence in a positive way, in a legal way, but the power of suasion in some respect over all of the sister agencies as well as the core of the city itself, and that's the mayor, who appoints a lot of the board and actually sits as the chair of the board on a couple of the sister agencies. So power is held in a unified way, but in some respect, oversight is somewhat balkanized on an individual governmental body basis. That poses some challenges, actually, for us up here and our ability to actually work together in what is, in some respects, a unified system. But then there are also some parts of it, not merely with respect to, say, suburban school districts, but with respect to the city itself, where there have been carve-outs. And one of the carve-outs is specifically audit oversight of programs of the city of Chicago that are actually managed out of the city council. And that's an unusual thing, to have a legislative body actually administering and managing what in any other place in the United States and in the world actually is an executive branch function. And so that's not a good thing. It ends up being a dark space, a black box, where hundreds of millions of dollars actually end up being expended with no oversight whatsoever. That's not an acceptable situation, and it is something that there was an endeavor to address through legislation 2 years ago, and for which certain very shrewd parliamentarians within the city council carved out that one piece, and someday it actually should be addressed.
Okay, thank you. We have some really good questions up here, so we'll try to answer as many as we can. This is from Peter Landau, City Club member. Peter, where are you? Oh, over there. Sorry, far right. This area, referring to the Chicago metropolitan region, I assume, has a reputation for needing oversight. How do we compare to other major metropolitan areas? Are we in need of better laws that can better prevent conflicts of interest and corruption? Who would like to start on that? Nick?
I think just briefly, having worked at the City of Chicago Inspector General's office under David Hoffman and Joe here, sitting here. And so I think you have to look at it two ways. You know, how far have we come from where we were, and how far do we need to go? And I think Joe can probably talk a lot about that in terms of where we need to go with the city. Pat's talked about, the progress of the county. But, I think there was a terrible lack of oversight. I think the OIG's, movement is sort of on the map now, which is important. People are starting to really have an idea about what they do. I think collectively there's a fairly good body of work being put out from IGs that is sort of raising the profile and the persuasive power of the IG community. The IGs are speaking publicly, which is a good thing. The carve-out areas Joe was talking about, and these areas of, making sure that all the IGs are robust enough, that they all have adequate powers, that they're statutorily enabled, they have subpoena power. I think that those sorts of and making sure the right and critically the right person has the jobs. Those are the things that will advance the ball even farther.
Good. You want to add something to that, Pat and Joe?
Yeah, if I could quickly. So Chicago as a municipality in all of its component parts relative to major cities around the country actually is on the right side of the line. It's actually one of the leading municipalities for oversight. And so it goes, but the issue goes more to the nature of the oversight. And so I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's sort of a balkanized nature of oversight in ways that don't allow the IGs to actually work together. That's one. Two, they're all somewhat differently empowered. They're all somewhat differently resourced. Nick's office, putting aside the recent expansion for the purpose of addressing sexual harassment and abuse situations, it is a tiny office relative to the massive size of the agency that he is charged with overseeing. There should be a protected budget for everybody. There should be subpoena power for everybody. There should be the capacity that Pat noted, the recent improvement of his authority to actually enforce those subpoenas, and so on and so forth. All of the IGs need to be on that same platform. The variation in the capacity of one body to get at something when the others aren't bring into question and disrepute the actual work that's being done by the others. And there also needs to be a big upstep across the board in the capacity of IGs to actually report publicly on what it is that they do.
Pat, do you have anything you would like to add?
I agree, of course, with Joe and Nick. The one thing I would like to highlight, Will Fletcher is the president of the local chapter of the National Association of Inspectors General. That organization has what is referred to as a green book, which is a best practices. One of the elements that Joe suggested, which really all OIGs should have, and to my understanding, very, very, very few do, is have a funding floor. So much so that the government body itself has to fund the office to at least a certain degree. And it's generally recommended. I believe that's 1/10 of 0.0001 of the overall budget. And I think Joe's office right now, the city is funding it 0.14 or so. That's the minimum floor. Cook County, we don't have a minimum floor for funding, so that's something that's we would aspire to. I think it's very important that every office does at least have that minimum floor for funding.
Okay, this is an interesting question. It comes from a federal government employee who's not here in any official capacity, and I'm not going to ask him or her to stand up and tell us who they are, but their first name is Ashley. We appreciate that, and we respect your privacy. Here's the question. What is the stance of each OIG office present on the topic of releasing raw, unvalidated, unanalyzed data? My agency is in a debate as to should unvalidated data be released. The fear is that inaccuracies could cause undue stress or reactions? Boy, that's a juicy question. Who would like to take the lead on that one?
Well, I think my initial thought is the nature of the data, it seems to me, is going to drive the answer to that question. Certainly, there could be asterisks placed alongside any ledger with data that's contained on it, which would give somebody notice that, this may not be accurate. I mean, that's probably what would satisfy the concern. But if the data is of a certain nature, I don't know if I'd even go down that road for a number of reasons.
Joe?
So our office is actually trying to avoid that question through an initiative that will bring data forward to the public in a clean, reliable, and user-friendly way. In the city, because of the traditional, somewhat sort of politically and patronage-based origins, city departments operated as their own silos. And they generated their own data through their own systems. There was not any sort of enterprise-wide management of the data. And so over the last 3 years, our office has been identifying databases, negotiating access, back-end access to those databases, and then going through the process of cleaning the data. And along the way in cleaning the data, what you end up doing as an IG is identifying all sorts of standards for which city departments and programs actually should be inputting and managing the data themselves. But once we clean the data, it is now sort of being configured into what is essentially a data warehouse for the city, through which, beginning in a few weeks, we'll be putting forward an information portal that will have dashboards of key indicators with respect to the composition of the city and its operations, aspects of its performance, and this is an enterprise-wide function, so that the public actually can engage the information. It'll all be on a Tableau platform, and people will be able to go on and actually put their own filters and generate their own dashboards, all with the idea of one thing: putting elected officials, the public, and government program and department operators on the same platform with respect to information and facts. One of the things about Chicago and Illinois is that we expend huge amounts of our civic energy, our litigation energy, our political debate arguing about facts on less than complete information. And we can't get to the solutions unless we can all agree on the facts. And we can't agree on the facts unless we have all have access, meaningful access, in user-friendly ways to the same data. So that's what we're trying to do. It's a really challenging question that Ashley has put forward, because it's absolutely the case that if data is put forward that's unreliable, it is going to be misused, and it's going to be misused in ways that are going to confuse the public and make them even more mistrustful of the governments that we need to be building confidence in.
Thank you, Joe. Nick, I have a question for you. This question obviously wants your response. This is from Joy Clendenning and Andrea Tolsman. Raise your hands. Back there. Okay. They've been put down here. Raise your hands. Okay. Nick, what ethics requirements must the appointed CPS school board members follow? Would there be different ethics requirements if they were elected? Second part of that, how can the CPS IG office ensure support for whistleblower CPS employees?
So the first part, you know, there's a code of ethics that governs the conduct by CPS employees. There are specific rules that apply in that code to board members specifically. So, you know, I mean, that's broadly. I don't know if you're asking me to address a specific portion or not. I mean, generally, they have a fiduciary duty to act in the best interest of the school district and the board. They can't have conflicts of, you know, they can't have interests above a certain sort of de minimis level in contracts. With, you know, they need to recuse themselves. Those are sort of the broad provisions. You know, they have to, you know, make their conflicts known and recuse themselves. The second question was
Protection for whistleblowers.
So, you know, there is whistleblower protection under the school code, and, you know, people who come to our office, we do everything within our power to make sure that they're protected, and, you know, we've kind of vigorously enforced people, you know, circumstances where we think people might be retaliated against, and we challenge, the board when we need to. Without more, I don't know that, I guess they could be strengthened, but without knowing the specific instance or not, I don't know where we would strengthen that.
Okay, thank you. Let's try to squeeze in another question or two. This is from Dave Lundy over here with Aileron, City Club member. Transparency through the FOIA and Open Meeting Act laws has become a challenge as public bodies increasingly resist disclosure. How important are FOIAs and the Open Meeting Act in helping you do your jobs? Who would like to tap, Pat?
Well, it's not the FOIA and Open Meetings Act are not geared towards helping us do our jobs, but they're extremely important in fostering transparency, which we all, you know, support on a really very high level. FOIA is a statute that needs to be filed at every step of the way. It's been my understanding that not all Cook County governments have adequately adhered to their FOIA responsibilities. As a matter of fact, recently we released a report after an analysis of the assessor's office compliance with their responsibilities under FOIA and OMA, and unfortunately, you know, it was determined that a significant number of the FOIA requests presented to the assessor's office went unresponded to, and or went responded to inadequately. And just as disappointing was the failure of the office to respond to the public access counselor, which is the position within the state attorney general's office responsible for considering appeals for denial of FOIA requests. So having said that, I think that it's a great question, and it's something that needs to be considered by every local government. It's a very important issue.
Joe and then Nick, your comments on that?
Yeah, FOIA does not operate consonant with the values that it is supposed to be actually serving. And I think a lot of people in this room know that. And it has basically been, and look, lawyers got to do what lawyers got to do, but it's largely been co-opted by those with the information and the power to utilize through clever legal arguments all sorts of variations on a core set of exemptions, some of those exemptions actually being really important. But the fact of the matter is that FOIA and litigation in FOIA is used to avoid disclosure of a lot of public information, the litigation process used as basically a blocking mechanism. And to the extent information is provided, that information is provided only to clear the minimum bar of what the request is. And so when we talk about transparency in government, we really need to talk about a paradigm shift, a framing shift that moves our perspective and our animating impulse from not a standard of what answers a specific question or concern that's being raised, but what sort of information should we be putting forward that preempts the questions, that answers the concerns in the first place? All of those spending their time battling in FOIA litigation on both sides are doing what I was suggesting before, arguing about the facts and the basic information at a time when this community needs to be focused on the debates about the solutions.
Okay. Thank you, thank you. Nicholas, do you have
quickly, I would just say that I'll address the Open Meetings Act part. You know, I think I do have some concerns, in general, in local government, that that the minimum, again, that's what Joe was saying, the minimum is sort of being met, that there's a process, things are happening, but too many things or everything conceivable are being held in a closed session. And, you know, they really have control over what goes in closed session, you know, the people on the boards. And you don't know, you know, you don't, there's, you know, that's a black hole. And then on top of that, you know, our meetings specifically, you know, do board members meet in very small groups under the threshold requirement for having an open meeting? And so, you know, I think that happens. And so you have a lot of, you know, most of the substantive stuff being actually decided in small rooms. And it's not in, you know, the actual meetings just become kind of a formal show with no substance at all.
Okay, final question. Hopefully we can get a quick answer to this. It's from City Club member John Holden. John, where are you? Right down here. Good. Taking notes. Good. What percentage of your investigations have resulted in direct action? Do you have sort of a number that you could share with Mr. Holden?
Sure. Mr. Holden, I would say the devil, of course, is going to be in the detail. But the I'd say 85%, there is a number, and I just don't have it off the top of my head, but about 80 to 85% of the recommendations that we offer are adopted. Of course, the 15% are probably a bigger concern than the positive feeling that we have about the 85%, but one of the most difficult things that we face is follow-up. that will issue a recommendation, and it's a good recommendation. We think it is, and a reasonable person would agree with that. But in order to ensure that that gets proper consideration and implementation actually occurs, is a significant effort.
Good. Joe Ferguson.
If it's disciplinary, it is the rare exception that our findings and some form of implementation of our recommendations are not followed. So it's well over 90% on the investigation front. With respect to program audits and reviews, I'd say probably about half to two-thirds are acted upon. And look, that's not a bad number for this reason. Our recommendations are sort of lofted into a universe where folks actually have to run complex programs. Some of them are going to work, some of them aren't. Some of them can be funded, some of them can't be funded. But I will say this, and I think it's something that my colleagues up here would share. The response to our recommendations actually is tied to transparency of what it is that we do. And for public officials to know that our reports, recommendations are going to be in the public domain, that largely is what drives the responsiveness that we do get.
Nick, do you have any comment? Any?
They've said 95% of what I would say. The only other thing is it's aside from our discipline cases, which are acted on quite regularly, we've had sort of there's been a not a great history of following up on what we call policy recommendations or changes to procedure. Those definitely had been falling through the cracks in past years, and that's the area that we're trying to work on the most, is to track those, figure out where they are, and make sure that we have answers in our annual report for where those recommendations wound up.
Okay, we could keep going because we have a lot of questions coming in. You can see this was an incredibly interesting program. If you couldn't take it all down, we invite you to listen to our podcast on WGN Radio so that you can hear this once again. Let's give all of our panelists, Pat Blanchard, Joe Ferguson, Nick Schuller, a big round of applause.